move to the fifth case today, United States v. Turner.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Mr. Hill.
Hi, Judge Tender.
It's been a while.
It has been.
We both have more gray hair than we saw each other last.
We do. So good seeing
nice
you.
Nice to see you.
For the record, I represent Richard Turner, and essentially the reason that we are here is to try to get this court to evaluate Mr. Turner's situation and see why appropriate for this district to start possibly recognizing sentencing manipulation and sentencing entrapment. Mr. Turner, the record would show, was an individual who was a small-time drug dealer. He was the father of eight children. He spent most of his day babysitting five of those children while his spouse worked. He's an alcoholic. He's also dependent upon marijuana. He has no violent crimes in his background. Essentially, he would sell a third of a gram bag of crack cocaine in order to make ends meet. Essentially, what happened here was that the agents got him to deal in a larger quantity on two separate occasions, quantities that we submit were quantities that he was not predisposed to otherwise deal in. We understand that the laws are there to be followed by everyone, but Mr. Turner's an individual who was not a big-time drug dealer and not the type of person that we submit a sentence of 136 months was designed to punish. Now, he ended up in that situation because he was encouraged, we submit, to participate in two transactions that put him over the 50-gram minimum threshold. I mean, he had no history of ever dealing with that type of situation prior to this invitation to do so by law enforcement officers.
Did he show any reluctance to engage in these transactions?
After he was encouraged to do so, he took advantage of the opportunity to do so. I mean, I can't say reluctance. I can say that before the invitation was made, there's no evidence that he had any predisposition to engage in such large transactions. If you take a gram bag, which is what would be comparable to an equal bag, equal or sweet and low, his normal quantities was a third of such a bag. They get him to do a transaction on two separate occasions. Those two transactions accumulate to an amount over 50. I think it's 51.4 grams. That takes him above the threshold of 10 years. Now, he was initially charged with two counts. He pled guilty to one. The other charge was used as relevant conduct. What we attempted to do in this brief was to provide the court with a respectfully stated laundry list of ways in which this situation could be addressed. We know the court's history in this jurisdiction regarding sentencing manipulation and entrapment, but if a case was needed to change that rule, I think that Richard Turner's would be the one.
Mr. Hill, this court does recognize sentence entrapment.
I meant to say manipulation. I stand corrected.
But for sentencing entrapment, there has to be some sort of extraordinary inducement, doesn't there?
Exactly.
And what would you argue in this case satisfies that? Or are you saying that the standard should be lower for that, less than extraordinary?
Well, I'm saying that every case should be evaluated on the facts of every case. But in this case, you know, they went and said, will you do the deal? I mean, I can't say they twisted his arm or, you know, waterboarded him or something like that.
Yeah, and the amount of money they were offering wasn't out of line for that quantity of crack.
Yeah, but given his financial situation, I mean, he's got eight kids. He's taking care of five of them. He's unemployed. They gave him an opportunity to make a few dollars more than what he'd otherwise be able to hustle on his.
Wasn't there something wrong with this crack, too? It had
His customers didn't like it because it had a taste of gasoline. I mean, he had a bad product.
He was able to unload a larger quantity.
He wasn't a very good businessman. He wasn't. I mean, what he was doing primarily is, I submit, trying to make ends meet while his lady friend worked during the day and he took care of the children. And then you look at his offense level. It gets pushed up. We thought maybe it'd be a level 3. It gets pushed up to a level 6 because he's got a whole history of traffic violations and minor infractions with the law. Now, I'm not making light of that. But given the scale of offenses that I've had an opportunity to be involved with representing clients over the years, you know, Richard Turner is not on your list of the most dangerous individuals that, you know, walk these streets. You've got a guy who we are saying was, I only got these ordinary Joe because Joe DePorme and all that. We've got a guy who is out there selling some rock, a third of a gram of rock on occasion. Agents come into the area and say, okay, we need to, you know, justify our paychecks, and we get a guy like this as opposed to going to the guys that are the real big dealers. And they get him to do this, and he does it, and he, of course, gets installed into this situation, and here we are.
He gets involved with the feds, right?
He gets involved in the feds, and whoever needed to get that, well, of course, we weren't able to. Well, the point is that it looks like you've got an overzealous federal agent taking a guy who is most vulnerable because of his meager financial situation and preoccupation with trying to take care of his family and his alcohol and his drug problem and get him to commit a crime that he never would have been able to afford to commit because he wouldn't have been able to get the resources necessary to accumulate those quantities. That's our position, Your Honors. It's not a whole lot of, I mean, the case law is pretty clear in this circuit as to what the rules are. What I'm trying to do is to get you to give special attention and take a look at Richard Turner to see whether or not this is a guy where, even though he did, and the judge did, I must admit, the judge did give him the bottom. He gave him not the bottom, but a lower range of the applicable guideline range. But given Mr. Turner's circumstance, immediately when he's taken into custody, he says, yeah, you got me, I did it. And then he ends up with 136 months when, based on our calculations, had the one transaction. Had he been arrested after the first transaction, he would have been doing maybe 27 to 33 months or so, based on Ms. Dogasheva's calculations. So that's our presentation, and I don't know, it's very complicated. It's a matter of your willingness to do it as opposed to understanding how to do it. I'm sure you know how to pick the one that would apply in the event that you were so compelled to give him some relief. And I do appreciate the opportunity to make this presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dill. Sir Harjani.
May it please the Court, Sunil Harjani on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, Defendant Turner was sentenced near the low end of the guidelines range in this case. He now offers this Court a plethora of reasons on why he purportedly should have received a lower sentence. At the outset, defendant attacks the government's investigation of this case through the doctrines of sentencing entrapment and manipulation. As the Court has recognized repeatedly, this circuit does not recognize sentencing manipulation, and this doctrine of sentencing entrapment is disfavored, as the Court has stated. That's for good reason. It requires a high hurdle with respect to sentencing entrapment. It requires a lack of a predisposition on the part of the defendant combined with unrelenting government pressure. That is not the case here, and the record does not support it. As Your Honor noted, the defendant here took advantage of the opportunity to unload his crack cocaine inventory. His customers were complaining that it tasted like gasoline, and he willingly engaged in the transaction, in not just one transaction, in two transactions, unloaded that and displayed a willingness to engage and sell that level quantity of drugs. Certainly the defendant could have pulled out after the first one, but he didn't. He engaged in two separate transactions. Moreover, there is nothing in the record here.
Why did they go ahead with the second transaction? There's not much doubt about his guilt.
Your Honor, that particular, the motive of the government agent is not in the record. But certainly the court has examined why government agents would want to do more than one transaction. And some of those may be applicable here to determine all the co-schemers in the case or other co-conspirators, to determine the full extent of the scheme, to determine whether there may be other drugs involved or other illegal conduct, or just to allow the defendant, as the court has stated, allow enough the defendant to hang himself in conducting multiple transactions. In particular here, what could have been taken place was to solidify the evidence. Oftentimes, two transactions is certainly better than one. None of this is in the record, but these are
some... carries a higher sentence.
It certainly carries a higher sentence, but a fact that this court has recognized is important here. It is the defendant that defendant's conduct that resulted in the predicament that he's in here now, not the government. The defendant willingly engaged in the transaction, took advantage of the opportunity to unload his crack cocaine inventory. Your Honors asked defendant if there was any reluctance on the part of the defendant, and the defendant conceded, no, there wasn't. There's nothing in the record demonstrating any reluctance by the defendant to engage in this transaction.
And as a matter of curiosity, it doesn't make any difference in the case. Was this a joint task force or just DEA agents operating, you know?
Your Honor, I do not know the answer to that question. And I don't believe it's in the record that we have before us either, since the case pled and there was no trial transcripts. And, Your Honor, with respect to the level of quantity that was purchased here, this court recognized in White that even though the case may involve a departure from the defendant's previous buying patterns, that where there shows a willingness to engage in that level of a transaction, that level of quantity, that is enough to show a predisposition to commit the crime. And without any outrageous government conduct, this is not the case for the court to apply the sentencing entrapment doctrine. I note that this court has never mitigated a sentence based on sentencing entrapment in the past, although it's recognized a doctrine. And this is certainly not the case to start with.
Do you think there's any inconsistency in the circuit recognizing sentencing entrapment but not manipulation?
Your Honor, there are some circuits that recognize sentencing entrapment and not manipulation. There's some circuits that go the opposite way and recognize manipulation and not entrapment. However, a survey conducted of all circuits, particularly those that the defendant cites in his reply brief, not one of those cases cited to this court. There's not a case cited to this court where a court has applied manipulation or entrapment to lower a sentence. In particular, and that's applicable to this case, the cases cited by the defendant in the reply brief actually involve multiple drug transactions. And in those cases, the court said those were fine, those were okay, because the reasons articulated by this court applies. Finding the full extent of the scheme, finding co-conspirators, finding the source of the drugs, or just allowing the defendant enough rope to hang himself. So for all those reasons, the court has declined to apply it in multiple drug transactions in a sting operation. And with respect to sentencing manipulation, while this court does not recognize it, it's important to note that even if it did, it would require outrageous government conduct, and there is nothing in the record to reflect that. The defendant also contended that he was placed in a criminal history category that was too high, and that is not the case. At age 26, defendant has accumulated 34 convictions and 39 arrests. His criminal history points are twice the number necessary to place him in criminal history, category 6. The district court found that significant. It found that the defendant was a recidivist and that his criminal history played a significant factor in the sentence he received at 136 months. The defendant had one conviction He had a conviction every year, 2001 through 2006, and in fact, five in 2005 alone. That showed the recency of his criminal history, not something that happened 10 or 15 years ago, but something that happened recent to the current incident. And on top of that, the defendant, the district court recognized the defendant had 39 arrests even, considered that under 3553A factors. And the district court considered that the defendant had prior drug convictions, in fact, four prior drug convictions, and that the defendant admitted that he had been a drug dealer for the past 7 years. For these reasons, the defendant found significant the criminal history, the need to protect the public, the deterrence necessary for the public, and also considered the seriousness of the crime. The court applied the 3553A factors consistently, recognized the guidelines range, and imposed a sentence near the low end of the guidelines range. Unless the court has further questions, we would ask the court to affirm the conviction.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Hill? You have 2 minutes, Mr. Hill.
Minutes. Briefly. There's no indication that the delay in arresting the defendant was based upon the government's desire to ensnare additional co-conspirators or give law enforcement agents a greater understanding of the nature of the criminal enterprise or to allow the suspect rope to hang himself. What they did was what the record shows is that the agents went out and got a person who was familiar with the neighborhood to get Turner to sell them some drugs. They knew that he was a solo operator. They knew that he wasn't a part of an elaborate or larger enterprise. And, I mean, they could have arrested him after the first sale, and he could have been out of commission. There was no, it's not like an investigation into a multi-individual enterprise. I just wanted to respond to that point. One other point is, and then after he was arrested, and I know he didn't talk about this, but he was put in Kankakee County Jail. I think that something needs to really be, I know this court has ruled on that previously in another case, but the conditions that individuals have to endure in that Kankakee County Jail, it's just deplorable, especially when you compare it, if you were to compare it with what's going on at the MCC. The computers don't work, they don't have contact visits, they don't have, the telephone costs are so expensive. I mean, it's really a denial of treatment between pretrial detainees that exist at that Kankakee County Jail and at other locations. And I think something needs to be done about that. I don't think that facility should be used at all. I mean, I visit guys down there regularly trying to attend to their representation needs. But, you know, given the disparity that exists, we raise that issue also because his conditions of pretrial detention were more severe than those experienced by similarly situated detainees. And if you could deal with that point somehow, we would very much appreciate it. And I do thank you for your opportunity.
Mr. Hill, we thank you for taking the appointment in this case and representing your client.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
See you, Judge.
All right. We move to the